Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, an Irish film, Losing Alaska, highlights climate change as melting permafrost sees homes disappear into rolling seas. We hear about an ambitious project from wildlife rehabilitators.
It's going to be a wildlife rehabilitation and training hospital. So it's going to be like a central hub, basically, for rehabbers all over the country. That's going to be in the Fingal area.
And fisheries scientist Ken Whelan.
I tell you why I can't find you. Every time I go out to your place, you gone fishing.
Is here with news from the World Salmon Forum in Seattle.
Gone fishing.
I'm real gone, man.
You ain't working anymore.
Could be.
There's your hole out in the sun where you left a row half done. You claim that hoeing ain't no fun.
But I can prove it.
You ain't got no ambition. Gone fishing.
Thankfully for us, he's back. Ken, you're very welcome back. You were in Seattle. What were you doing there?
Well, I was attending, Derek, what was called the World Salmon Forum. That may seem a very grandiose title, and I was a bit nervous about the title myself, to be honest, before we went out. But it was absolutely fantastic. It all came about as a result of one very passionate individual, a guy called Bruce McNee, who decided about maybe 4 or 5 years ago that he really needed to bring everybody together that was interested in salmon, because he has fished for salmon in the Atlantic and the Pacific and all over the world. And he felt we really needed to get together and try and see what we had in common in terms of the whole series of problems that we're facing and some of the great innovations that are now coming about in terms of trying to protect salmon. So it was a really wonderful success. And we had a really broad church. We had a big, big group of people from First Nations. We had people from California. We had people from Norway. We had people from some of the native peoples in Northern Europe. So it was a great collection of people. And we really, I think we learned a lot from one another.
Why were you there?
Well, the main reason that I was there was, you know, I work part-time at the Atlantic Salmon Trust. And this slightly suspects framework that we've been developing for a small number of years now, that really seems to have taken hold in terms of an approach to try and put together the various factors that may be affecting salmon. And obviously, salmon are complicated in that they spend half of their lives in salt water and half of their lives in fresh water. So it's a complicated business to bring all the threads together. And we were very pleased when, as part of this year, which is the International Year of the Salmon, one of the actual signature projects that was picked was this likely suspects framework. So my job was to go and explain to people what we were trying to do and to try and see for myself then the challenges they would have in trying to put their information into this framework so that eventually we can actually produce a management model that will help us in the Pacific and the Atlantic to be able to manage salmon better and, most importantly, to be able to conserve them.
Likely suspects framework. Sounds like the usual suspects movie, but what's that all about?
People are constantly calling it the usual suspects framework. But really what we're trying to do is, obviously, if you had in studio here 4 or 5 people from different parts of the salmon world, they would all have their particular the particular area that they themselves were convinced was the silver bullet. This is the issue that's killing off salmon. Is it climate change? Is it aquaculture? Is it dams? Everybody would have their own view. And really, as scientists, what we need to do is to try and look at these objectively. So we need to base everything on scientific hypotheses. So the idea of the framework is we're building what we call domains. So basically, we're building theoretical boxes within which we're going to collect all of the information that exists, and we're going to scientifically test it. We're going to see, is there any basis for people saying that dams are one of the top three issues in the world? Is there a basis for people saying that impacts from aquaculture are one of the top three impacts? And we're going to try and prioritise the research around what comes out of the analyses. So we will pick what we think are going to work best by way of solutions in terms of trying to solve what we think are the most important
problems. All right, so you say that salmon numbers are declining, presumably. Yeah. Now, how much have they declined in the last 10 10 years, for example, or the last two decades or five decades?
Well, certainly in the context of the Atlantic salmon, which the Pacific one I learned, that was why Seattle was so interesting to me. Seattle showed me just how complex the area, the Pacific area is. But on the Atlantic side, for example, say 30, 40 years ago, out of every 100 baby salmon that we're going to see, you could have expected to have back 20 to 25. Mm. We're now lucky to have 3 to 5 back. So it's a very, very dramatic decline.
And you're absolutely sure of that?
We're absolutely
sure of that.
And
you're sure of that because?
We don't know the because.
No. How are you sure of it, should I say?
I beg your pardon.
Because you were doing what?
We're very fortunate. And again, we only saw this in the last year by working with the people from the Pacific. We have a whole series of what we call index systems around Europe and North America for Atlantic salmon. And basically, I was fortunate enough to run one of these for 20 years in Mayo, the Burrish Shoal system. Every single fish that comes into the river and every fish that leaves is manually counted in Burrish Shoal. So we actually know the number of baby fish going to sea and the number of fish coming back since 1970. And that's a unique basis on which to be able to say definitively that the numbers coming back have very seriously dropped. We have other indices as well, but the index systems are the real crunch point in terms of knowing what's happening. And we're in a great situation, and this is what I was trying to explain in Seattle. As scientists, we'd have to actually look for the answer. In this case, we actually have the answer, and we're going to work backwards. So we know the number of fish going out. Mm-hmm. We know the number of fish coming back.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do with the suspects framework is to build a framework to explain exactly why this is happening
right. And
at what point it's happening.
Okay, so we know now there's a decline, certainly from the river, from Burrish Shoal where you were working. And prior to that, you were getting 20 from every 100 that went out. And the 80 that didn't make it back, that was due to predation, that was due to sickness. What was that due to? Do you have any idea?
Well,
first of all, we
would have a good, again, we have a whole series of theories. The idea of the framework is to try and put numbers on these theories. So yes, predation. Yes, in terms of the actual migration routes that they have to follow. So we did some, well, it was colleagues from Norway did this, some very fancy modelling where we looked at the patterns of movement of the fish relative to the currents and relative to the temperature of the seas. And we were able to show that quite normally in those times when we were getting our 20 back, there were times when you had very different surface currents when the fish were going out and they actually got blown off course, literally. They ended up going closer to Iceland than they did going to Norway. As a result of that, they basically got lost at sea. We know that was a factor. And also, we know that there were times when there was a bycatch where people fishing for mackerel and herring would have accidentally taken salmon. So they're examples of the sorts of things that were happening.
The idea of
a
salmon getting lost anywhere, Ken, is bizarre.
Well, we had a fantastic example of what might happen when we were in Seattle, because there was a young guy called Chase Williams, gave us the most fantastic paper on the work he's doing. You'll remember we talked a couple of times to the people in Galway who are working on ocean acidification in previous programs. What Chase is finding is that the actual cells in the noses of the salmon may be quite adversely affected by any change in terms of pH, in terms of acidity. And he put out the idea that if this was severe enough, the fish themselves might find it very difficult to actually navigate back, because their navigation systems are based on two things. They're based on electromagnetic patterns, the same as birds, but when they get close inshore and into rivers, they use their nose, they use their sense of smell and taste to get back home. So even acidification in the ocean could affect the way the fish and how successfully the fish can...
So it blinds them in effect?
Well, in fact, it blinds them in terms of a bit like bats, in the sense that their echolocation is actually novel. Now, what he did say, which was reassuring, was he thought it was probably temporary. But at the same time, he said he was giving us an indication that these changes in the ocean sometimes can be so subtle and so remote from what we know that we find it all very strange, and we're just not spending the time at sea to understand what's happening.
Now, I know Richard is itching to get in there before I let him in, so I want to bring it. Now we have an idea of what was happening, these 80 that weren't coming back and the 20 were coming back. And then you say, now we see this decline and the numbers are down to 3 or 4, if we're lucky, making it back from that 100 that have gone out. And you're trying to find out what are now the factors that are causing that. And that's what your usual suspects
game is all about, if you like. And you mentioned aquaculture.
Yeah.
And what else did you mention there?
We've mentioned dams.
And dams.
Yeah.
So can you explain how aquaculture is affecting salmon? How are dams affecting salmon? And the one thing you haven't mentioned at all is fellas like you who go fishing.
Absolutely. Yes, that's right. So let's deal with the fishing one first. So what has happened, not just fellas like me, but fellas who did this for a living have been very hard hit. So we have a situation where in a lot of countries, such as Ireland, Norway, Canada, the big commercial fisheries have actually been closed to try and save fish. So nobody goes and does high seas fishing anymore. In the case of anglers, a very large number of rivers in Ireland since 2007 are closed on an annual basis, depending on what the prognosis is in terms of the numbers of fish coming back. And anglers are only allowed to keep very small numbers of salmon now. So that's number one. In terms of aquaculture, massive debate going on at the moment, really huge debate, which has been going on for nearly 30 years now, as to the effects of sea lice, whether or not sea lice infesting the salmon on their way out to sea, the burden of sea lice is so heavy, this is again just a theory, that the fish, there's a much higher mortality as a result of these lice infestations, and that we get poorer numbers coming back. Obviously, that can only happen where there are salmon farms. Again, we have a second programme at the moment that we're just planning off the west coast of Scotland, which we think will be able to tackle that and be able to quantify that for the framework. The third one then, the dams. The dams one is really interesting because you would imagine that the only problem with a dam is the dam. What we're finding is it's not so much the dam as what it's doing to the fish. It's actually delaying the fish. And as a result of delaying the fish, we're back to, boom, predation again.
All right.
So we're back, not alone to birds. We had a very interesting experience now about 2 years ago where we had a programme funded by a group that were mainly interested in angling. And we went back and we said, well, we have the results. And they said, well, it's the birds, isn't it? And we said, no, it isn't. It's the trout. And they said, what? Because they like catching their trout. So in reality, if you have a situation where you have small silver fish held up at the back of a dam and you have very large trout, those trout absolutely love to eat baby salmon. So it may not be the easy connection that you would make.
So the problem isn't on the way back, the problem's on the way out.
It's in both directions. But our problem with the way out is that the question you asked, was this always the case? We had this discussion only last week. We now have ways of looking at what's happening on the way out that we didn't have before. Definitely a high proportion of what we're looking at on the way out has been there for a long time. But this is the real trick. What can we do about all of this? There's only one thing we can do, and that is to put more wild fish out into the ocean in the expectation that if we get more baby fish out, we'll be able to at least compensate for part of the problem.
You're not going to pick them up in one of these big helicopters that picks up water and drop them out, because they've got to find their way downriver to find their way back upriver, presumably.
No.
So how do you get more fish
out? Exactly. So this is the real challenge. It's the core of what AST is trying to do, because we said we have to produce practical solutions. Let me give you one example of what we've succeeded in doing. There's a young biologist who's a hero of mine now in Scotland, Lorraine Hawkins. And Lorraine, for the last 3 or 4 years, has been doing big tracking studies on the River Dee in Scotland. What was always suggested was that when they did major dredging in Aberdeen Harbour, that was coincidental with the movement of salmon out, that it was going to have a big impact on the salmon. Her science has actually shown that the impact is very significant. As a result of that, there's now a new bylaw so that you can't have any dredging in the harbour in Aberdeen during the smolt run. And that's going to save quite a percentage of smolts on their way out. So that's a perfect example of the series of things we want to try and get done. We have another very crazy idea, which some of the gillies in Scotland have been pressing us on for a while now. They've actually been shepherding the smolts out of some of the smaller rivers.
How?
By scaring the cormorants and by scaring the goosanders over the 3 week period while the smolts make it out, and then leaving the birds to the rivers without killing anything, just by keeping them away from the smolt shoals. Now, we don't know whether that'll make a significant impact.
How many would they be taking, Ken?
Well, very significant numbers.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, that's again due to what we've been doing.
But presumably
here
they've always been there.
They've always been there.
And there's a lot of pressure on seabirds at the moment as well.
But there's a lot. Some of them, the mergansers and gooseanders, some of them now are not native species. We need to find the numbers. We have to go know the numbers. And we have a great technique that was developed here in Dublin in UCD with some funding from the Atlantic Salmon Trust. We've developed this eDNA assay, this eDNA probe. So we can actually, and that's what we're planning to do this year, we're going to start looking at the bird scat, and we're going to be able to tell exactly how many salmon these particular birds have actually eaten. And also, because of the fact when they release the scat, they release some cells from their gut, we may be able to tell which birds are the specialists in terms of eating salmon or eating trout.
Okay, so when you've discovered that it's the cormorant that's picking off all the salmon, okay, and not the shag, what are you going to clobber all the cormorants?
No, but what we can do is...
Why do you want to know that then?
But as I say, what we think may be the case, we certainly have some evidence of this, there are specialists, whether it's cormorants or whether it's seals or whatever, these animals actually get to be specialists in a particular area, in a particular location. And it may be that you could actually manage the population by keeping those specialists away from the river at that particular time. So these are tough questions.
I know, but they're surviving on the basis that these salmon are coming down and they're going there. Like the brown bear in Alaska are going up because they know the salmon run.
Yeah.
And they're there to catch the fish and they depend on them at that time of year for their fuel, their food.
But there may
be... You're hardly going to alter their feeding patterns, are you?
Well, we may be able to because there's...
But should you?
There may be a very small percentage of them, of the birds that actually feed on salmon. The perception is that they're all feeding on salmon. There may only be a component of the population that's feeding on salmon.
But should you interfere at all?
Well, that's what we have to find out. That's why the framework will only work with numbers. So we're asking people to give us numbers and we're getting lists of ideas. And we're saying, no, we can't do anything with ideas. Tell us the science. Tell us the numbers. So we actually, they're the sort of difficult problems that we have to tackle. So if we have a situation where we're trying to save these smolts, we have to find a sensible management regime that will actually...
And that's just one river, Ken.
That's just one river.
So I mean, you're going to have to do this study on every single river, every salmon river in the world?
That's not the way the salmon world has worked up to this, in that with the, say, for example, the index systems, we apply the science from the very solid science of the index systems, we apply that to the other rivers. That's generally the way we do it. And certainly we were very heartened in the Pacific, where they have five different species of salmon, that they were willing to actually look at this approach and see if they could actually make sense of it. I mean, we're all over the place if we don't follow some sort of logical pattern, and the framework actually gives us the pattern to be able to do that with a very, as I say, very clear goal. And the goal is to get more of these precious wild fish into the migration routes that are heading north. And that's really what we're about.
Let me tell you who else is here today. We've got Richard Collins, as always, and Tom Burke, who's an Irish filmmaker. Hello, Tom. We'll talk to you about your movie Losing Alaska very shortly. But Richard, I could see you were itching to get in there.
Well, I'm not exactly itching to get in for a row with Ken, because he would send me out for six within 2 minutes. You know, he'd count me out. But I'm wondering if the Celtic Sea is becoming a kind of the equivalent of what used to be the Bay of Biscay. I'm wondering if there really is an actual decline in the population, or whether due to climate change, the whole population has shifted northwards. This part of the country, this part of Europe, is no longer that suitable. Now, your Boris Kuehl statistics, if they were carried out on a Norwegian river, or an Icelandic one, for instance, would you have the same decline that you have here? Has that been done? The salmon up there have far shorter distances to travel than our ones have. The poor old salmon from here has got to go farther north than ever he did before because the water is now warm and he's got to go further north. More time exposed to risk. Or is there anything in that idea?
Well, you've put your finger on it. I mean, that is the kernel of... We didn't quite get to the point where we were explaining why the 80% died. Why is it that we now have 95% dying? And those changes in the ocean are absolutely fundamental to this. The answer to your question is probably yes to most of them. There's an equivalent system in Norway called the Ems River. So we have worked very, very closely with the Ems. There's the Bush in the North Esk in Scotland and the Ems. We've worked very closely. And most importantly, with an equivalent river called the Scorff in France. Because just recently, I was really, really pleased to see that we have one river in Portugal that has Atlantic salmon. And we had thought perhaps they had disappeared. But there are still remnant stocks there. Can you imagine coming from Portugal as a little baby salmon and then ending up in Norway? That's an enormous journey. So you're absolutely right. the changes in the Southern Ocean seem to be a huge factor. And I was very shocked to see just how consistent that was in the Pacific as well. So in terms of Northern Norway, Finland, Russia, those areas at the moment are not seeing the declines that we're seeing in the southern areas. So it is that it is those southern stocks that are being hardest hit. And Salcy showed us very clearly that the warming of the surface layers of the ocean and the changes in terms of the plankton, we had a fantastic meeting with some marine scientists a few months ago who are experts in plankton. And even the change in planktonic species, where the species might be a bit bigger or less nutritious, could have a major impact with these fish because their timing is absolutely acute. They have to go out at a particular time to hit a particular current to take the bus north. They are assuming the food is there for them in those currents. If that food pattern has changed, it could have a major impact. And that's one of the areas that we'd be looking at.
The blob. Anything on the blob? Is that coming back? In the famous,
well, we had lots and lots of discussion about
blobs. You better explain what the blob is.
We have two blobs. I don't know whether Richard's aware.
One in the Pacific and
one in the Pacific, one in the Atlantic.
And
the one in the
Pacific.
Yeah, the one in the Pacific is the warm blob. But we have a cold blob.
But that should be good.
Yes. So the cold blob is good, but the warm blob they're very worried about in the Pacific. Basically, it's a zone. I am no expert in this, but it's a zone within the North Atlantic. This is the cold one, where we have an unusually cold regime of temperature within that particular area of the ocean. So the oceanographers are trying to understand why this blob, this cold zone, if you like, came about. It then, as I understand it, it has melted away to some extent in terms of getting warmer, now beginning to build again. And they have the equivalent in the Pacific, but it's the exact opposite. They've had very warm blob in the Pacific Ocean, which is now becoming cooler. So they are trying to understand this and understand the consequences of it. But everything is indicating these massive changes in the ocean. And while we were in Seattle, probably the most worrying thing that we were all watching was what was happening in Greenland. Because this year in Greenland, they had an extraordinarily warm summer. And you may have seen this on the television. As a result of that, we had increased melting of the actual ice cap. And for the first time, we had glaciers actually melting. They are doing that. All that fresh water is going out on top of Irish and Scottish salmon, predominantly in that zone, which are feeding in the ocean. And we know from our work so far that the salmon, when they're at sea, much prefer full salinity. They don't like a lot of fresh water. The amount of fresh water going into the oceans at the moment is enormous.
But how does it damage them, Ken?
Or does it
damage them at all?
We're not sure whether it damages them. It may mean that they will move to different locations. But again, it may be to do with the food. It may be to do with the fact that it actually changes the composition of the food in that particular area. And the other thing that we're looking at, which I think is really interesting, and it's some of the clever French modellers that are looking at this, what's driving all of this really in terms of why the fish are dying is what we call in science terms energetics. So how much energy are you taking in? How much energy are you expending? And what size do you expect to be when you get back? And these baby salmon are going to see at maybe 12 or 15 centimetres, 4 or 5 inches long. And they're expecting to come back at 60 centimetres in a little over a year. So they're not going to be expending or shouldn't be expending much energy. They should be layering on the fat the whole time. And if they spend their time trying to move around, look for food, trying to find other currents being affected by the fresh water in the oceans, the actual energetics may be such that the fish will basically run out of energy. They may die, or they may end up in a situation where they get thinner, or they may end up in a situation where they spend longer at sea and wander around looking for food in order to mature. So the energetics of this is really, really complex, but it may be key in terms of why we're losing so many fish. Because, as I say, we expect them to go out into these big currents and to come back a little over a year later as 5 or 6 pound fish. And to do that, they have to eat all the time on the very best of food.
Ken, you mentioned melting ice from Greenland and the freshwater content is increasing around that island. Surely there is a good side to that. You were at the great marriage in Seattle between the Pacific and the Atlantic, and you all got together and made friends and were in speaking terms with each other for the first time. And the sea itself has broken through, and you have this passage now between the Pacific, through the Northwest Passage, the famous Northwest Franklin and all the rest. But that will be largely fresh water as a result of what you say, the melting of ice. And that will act as a barrier to things going across from the Pacific to the Atlantic and vice versa. Is this a factor? Is this a help?
Well, first of all, I can't comment on because I just don't know whether I take your point in terms of being fresh water. But in terms of the Northwest Passage, there was a lot of discussion about the Northwest Passage in terms of the movement of jellyfish and so on through that at the moment. And we have a situation where, based on the very rough calculations we had available, probably about 1,000 kilometres at the moment between feeding Chinook salmon and feeding Atlantics. And we do know that in Greenland, some of the new streams that are being caused as a result of the ice not freezing, some of the new streams are being colonised by these very lovely fish called Arctic char, which are very close relative to the salmon. And they're much more adaptable in terms of fresh and salt, a bit like our sea trout. But they're beginning to colonise these streams. We may be seeing what happened 10,000 years repeating itself, where these rivers may begin to be colonised as well. The honest truth is, we don't know. The idea, the framework is to try and force people to put data into it, put information into these domains, and let's test it. Let's see what the information is telling us. And let's then try and link it together with a model or a series of models so we can understand and indeed predict what's going to happen in the future.
Ken, stay with us if you would. We're going to talk now to Tom Burke. Tom is an Irish filmmaker and he's made a movie called Losing Alaska. We'll let you listen to a clip of it and then Tom will tell us all about this movie.
Grandfather, he used to say, this new talk will become one big island. It's already an island. We've got river around us. And when the high wind comes in, it's like this one big island surrounded by the water. Water.
I think people who are thinking about staying here forget that it floods here in the fall. People who stay need to be prepared to be devastated by some kind of flood.
Our elders used to warn us about this kind of weather before. I don't know how they knew, but they used to say, this land will be gone after they pass down to the next life. And this year's been the worst erosion ever. Eating land like it was candy.
In 2003, we lost 150 feet of land from water washing away land. The nearest home to the water is about 100 yards. We are going to have a disaster if we don't move. We need to act as soon as possible before the water gets to us or it will eat us like Cookie Monster eating cookies.
The land just falls down and it cannot pick itself up.
I think we're a part of America that the rest of America forgot.
Now, New Talk is a small village of 375 people in Alaska. The plight of its residents brings into sharp focus the issue of climate change and the devastating impact it's having. In this instance, on this impoverished native Alaskan Yupik community, because their houses are slowly but surely sliding into the Ninglick River as the land upon which they were built is worn away by coastal storms and thawing permafrost. As I said, Tom Burke is the Irish filmmaker who's made this movie titled Losing Alaska. Tell me more, Tom.
Well, you've said a lot of it there. I've been visiting the village since 2015, attracted by this story of primarily the story of climate change, coastal erosion, the idea that you could see in front of you with the camera land falling into the sea, the literal effects of climate change, unambiguous effects of climate change. That was the first thing that drew me in. The second thing that drew me in was this idea that they were going to pioneer a new village, which I always think is a very American concept, this idea that we can kind of pick everything up and move up the road. And then the third element was this tribal dispute, this rift in a small village of less than 400 people. You had this very fundamental rift between these two factions, and that was preventing them from moving forward. And I thought all those three things together had the makings of a good story, combined with some visually, like a place that looks like no other.
Well, describe it for us.
You've got, Newtok is on what they call the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, so it's between these two enormous rivers, the Yukon and the Kusko. It's a part of Alaska that nobody really cares about, because if they were slightly further south, there would be the commercial fishing of Bristol Bay. If they were slightly further north and further north again, there would be oil, there would be mineral deposits. Where they are, there's nothing. There's nothing that the Western world is really interested in. So they are incredibly isolated. It's 70 miles to Chivac, it's 40 miles to Tuksuk, it's 90 miles back to Bethel. So if you can imagine flat, flat tundra and kind of nothingness in every direction. As a filmmaker, as a visual storyteller, it was an incredible place to be able to work.
Why you? I mean, you said you've been going there since 2015. Why? What brought you up there in the first place, if it's so remote and isolated?
I'm always interested in how communities work. Why do people choose to gather up together and live together, and then why do they stay together? What are the dynamics that make that work? So I had made a film in Dublin years ago about the Liberties, which was very much along those lines, kind of what makes a community coherent and how does it function. I thought I could bring those interests to Alaska and kind of examine some of the same issues, but in the context of this threat.
Yeah, but you just picked yourself up from where? Where are you from originally?
Malahide.
Malahide. And you pick yourself up, so Richard lives out there too, but you pick yourself up from Malahide and you deposit yourself here in Utah.
To be honest though, if you're interested in this line of work, if you're going to make documentaries,
how did you hear about them is what I'm wondering, you know. Give me the background to the story.
I read about them in The Guardian in 2013, 2014. Okay. So that's where I kind of got these stories, the three elements that I talked about. And indeed, the reporter for The Guardian did an excellent series of articles. Right. But the series of articles can only tell you so much. Your listeners would have just heard Raman and Grant and Bosco. There's a very particular way that the Yupik speak. There's a particular rhythm to it that can't really come across in a newspaper article. That flat tundra, that incredible landscape, that can't really come across in a newspaper article. And I think what a feature documentary can bring to it is this kind of longitudinal aspect, where I have the luxury, thanks to the way Screen Ireland operates, I'm able to go over a period of 3 years and really follow things in a calm way and not to a particular deadline. Which the newspaper also would have. So that's some of the reasons why.
How do they live there? What's their industries?
There's no industry.
So what is it?
It's subsistence.
Do they have money? Excuse my ignorance now.
They do. No, it's a fair question. And I've been asked that question before. The economic backbone of the village is a subsistence lifestyle. So in any given month, they are out fishing or hunting for the particular animal.
Yeah,
that's available
in
that season. So there would be salmon fishing in the summer, preceded by herring fishing. After that, there would be halibut. After that, there would be moose. After that, there would be muskox. Geese are plentiful all year round. They shoot tamarins. So whatever the month is, they will be trying to catch something different and kind of fill up the freezers. Mm. Beyond that, there are some government jobs within the village. There are some native corporations. There's a shop, there's a school, there's a small amount of employment, but really that subsistence lifestyle is the backbone of the economy.
But their houses are falling away into the river.
The land...
I got this right now. I mean, it must be some big river if your house is falling into the river, you know.
the river is quite big. The land has been falling away year by year since the late 90s. And slightly before. So they identified this as a problem around 1996, and they said, if this pattern continues, we think we're going to have a problem in the, around about now actually, in the early part of this century. And so the planning began then. When I first went in 2015, there was maybe somewhere around 100 metres to go, just under 100 metres from Nathan Tom's house all the way to the edge. And I went in March, and when everything was totally frozen and nothing was moving, and I was looking at it skeptically, going, you know, really, is it really going to become a problem very soon? Two trips later, and about 40 of those meters were gone already. And on my last trip, Nathan Tom's house was 10 feet from the edge. Now, his house has since been demolished before it could fall into the river. But that, again, it is not ambiguous at this point. The coastline is retreating. In my 3 or 4 years looking at the village, that 100 metres is gone. And even more than that now, the site that Nathan's house occupied now doesn't exist anymore.
And what's the cause?
They will tell you that the cause is a general warming of the temperatures such that the permafrost, which is supposed to be, you're supposed to get about one or two feet down and you hit permafrost. And that's always, as the name suggests, that's always frozen. The top layer, which is kind of this boggy, turfy layer, that freezes and unfreezes every season. And that's a process that happens. What has been happening is the unfreezing, the melting, has been going down further, down through the ground. And then when the freeze comes, the freeze is coming later and it's shorter. So they are used to winters that really get going in late October. Mm-hmm. And for the last few years, there's been no snow on the ground on Christmas Day. So they're seeing those kind of changes. So the permafrost that used to be able to resist the tide and the storms because it was frozen solid is now not able to resist those storms. And when the storm comes in, again, it's like this boggy material. You see it in the film. It gets undercut and it falls
down. And it's
down.
Just eroded. So it's global warming. Climate change,
yeah.
Ken, you've been in this part of the world, I'm sure, in Alaska.
Yeah, I have. And it's very similar to similar situation. You'll see just across, as we were speaking about the other side, in terms of the tundra I know best is in a place called the Kola Peninsula in Russia, which reminded me so much of Tom's film last night. And his description is perfect in the sense that in a big river system, you have natural erosion and deposition. So you have land being eroded by the currents, you have land then being built up then by banks of gravel and so on. But I think it was Jackie on the film last night explained really well what the problem was. And fundamentally, there's a big aspect to this which the film captures, which is not just the climate change, but why are the people here? If they're hunter-gatherers, if they're nomadic people, why are they in this very unusual spot?
Why don't they move?
Absolutely. And Jackie explained that really well in terms of the socio-political reason why these people were actually encouraged to take up this particular location. And I won't go into it in detail, but she was basically saying that when there was
quite a spoiler alert. Can I just say for the benefit of the listener, you didn't miss it. Ken had a preview, as did Richard, of the movie, so it hasn't been broadcast yet. Come on, tell us, Ken.
So really what I was going to say was that the reason the people have been there is because there was a decision made that the town should be built in that particular location. Whereas in reality, the town really should have been built on slightly higher ground. So they were a hostage to fortune, as I understood it.
A decision made by the federal government rather than by the tribes themselves.
Yeah. So they were a hostage to fortune to some extent. But this loss of the permafrost and this disappearance of the tundra, I did some work on the Kola a few years ago where our job was to fly into the tundra and actually look at the effects that this was having in terms of the upper parts of these salmon rivers. And certainly with the Sami people in that location, they were very concerned over this because it looked very similar. This was way inland now. This wasn't the sea, but there were massive areas of still water. There were lakes, there were ponds, all sorts of things. This is 1 million acres, the area I was looking at. So they were very concerned over the effects that the waves in the lakes were having on the permafrost that was now only semi-permanent, and where they were having the same issues in terms of very late winters, very severe shorter winters in what would have been their early spring, but much later than they would have seen. And this was impacting on their system of life as well. So they were forced into a situation where they were now beginning to over-harvest some of their particular resources because the other resources that would have come with the very harsh winter were not appearing on time. So I could relate so much to the movie. I thought it was fantastic, and it tells this, the social side of it as well as the biological and the physical side of the global warming issue.
Tom, looking at your film, I thought of two things. Pyrite in Ireland.
Okay.
And building houses on floodplains. It seems to me that we don't have to go all the way to Alaska to find a very acute parallels. It also came into my head, looking at your excellent documentary, you are in a great tradition. Robert Flaherty, was half Irish, his mother was half German, but he is described as the father of documentary. He was the Man of Arran was a famous example, which we might talk about in a minute, but he also made one called Nanook of the North, which I remember seeing on the Film Society circuit back in the 1960s. Yes, it was a black and white film with captions in between, and it described Nanook and his ferocious struggle with nature and adversity, and him making igloos and hunting walruses and all this kind of stuff, do you see? It actually goes back to Singh, I think, because Singh was the original perpetrator of this kind of thing with his Aran Islands and what's her name? Riders to the Sea, you know. And they're all gone now. And there's nothing the sea can do to me anymore. And I'll have no need to be queening when the wind breaks from the south and all this kind of stuff, you know. But actually, I remember Gustin Martin in UCD when we were studying that particular place saying, you know, if you look at the statistics for people killed or drowning in the Aran Islands, they were no worse than anywhere else. The odd fishermen drowned, and there were big tragedies like the one in Achill, but this was a total fabrication. And then Flaherty took that up and made a totally ridiculous film, in a way, a factually ridiculous film.
No, hang on a second. You started off by liking him to Flaherty. Now you're saying
I have loved about your film is that you didn't go down that ancient Irish road of exaggeration and what's the phrase? Sexing it up is the phrase.
No.
You gave a very accurate, it seemed to me, account of it, and you didn't exaggerate at all.
No, and in a way, again, I'm lucky in the way the film was made. I've got space to be subtle. Nobody is looking for a dramatic fifth act. I have a responsibility, because I'm making a documentary, that it should be rooted in fact and it should be honest. And in a way, the fact there isn't a dramatic climax to the film, that's not a spoiler alert. It is an observation of reality, and it's also not necessarily providing any conclusions. It's giving you a window into this community that most Irish people will never ever get the opportunity to go to, and presenting as many characters and circumstances as I could. And the viewer has to do an amount of work to make up their own mind as to what they think is going on.
But what did you set out to do? Did you set out to say global warming, climate change is a problem, these people are losing their homes, or here is a kind of snapshot in time, over 3 years albeit, of a community that live on the edge?
No, I think, again, you have to be very careful not to have too much of a plan. I remember in early days when I used to pitch ideas, and you'd pitch a documentary idea and they'd say, well, what's the ending? And you'd have to say, I don't know yet, because the story hasn't played out yet. Again, because of the way the film was funded, I had the luxury of going, I'm going to investigate this because I think it's interesting, and I don't know what the ending is going to be. So I didn't know if they were going to successfully found a new village. I didn't know if a terrible storm would appear at some point in that 3 years and wipe out several houses. I had permission to be curious and to go and investigate.
Did they found a new town? Did a storm come along and wipe out all the houses?
I encourage people to go and see the film and find out.
But we'll say where you can do that shortly.
What I would say is, and the film has been doing festivals around Europe, and I get asked that question in terms of, you know, what is the film trying to do? I guess the film is trying to be a cautionary tale in the broader sense about climate change. If it was only about climate change, it wouldn't be a very interesting film, I don't think. It should be about people facing this slow-moving disaster. And the cautionary tale is, here is a village where the effects of climate change, the threat to them, is unambiguous, and yet they have found it very, very hard to marshal the resources to get them to
safety.
Why?
Is it the federal government don't care? The local government doesn't care? Or they, yeah, they're a little bit manana themselves. What's the situation?
There are layers. There are definitely layers. As I said earlier, they're not in a part of Alaska that anybody particularly cares about. Mm. They are not resource rich. Mm. They're in a native Alaskan village. They're a very small constituency. They don't have a lot of political power. There is an amount of inherent racism in the whole thing. As we were talking about, the whole reason the village was there in the first place is that the federal government said, it was actually three separate tribes, they said, you three tribes will settle here, your children will attend that school, and if they do not, we will take your children and send them to our boarding school. So it's a kind of a shameful chapter in Alaska and the United States history. So there are several factors as to why it has taken them this long. And again, the viewer can kind of transplant that then to, well, if some other community was under threat, what would be the variables? If this was happening in Miami, would it have taken them so long? If it was happening in Hong Kong...
The national emergency declared immediately. Surely they have conversations and they say, your house is about to fall into the sea, we better do something about that.
They do, but again, they're somewhat disempowered from...
Well, we're simplifying it now.
From doing that. A little bit, yeah. They are American citizens. Mm. They are, you know, they are their own tribe. But if they, a lot of those houses were put there by the federal government. And so if they were to go and try and jack one up and move it, questions would have to be answered. So in a way, when you take the tribe that was seasonally, what's the word I'm looking for, migratory, a link there got broken in the 50s and 60s when they said you can't go from... There was winter camp, there was summer camp, there was fish camp. You can't do any of that anymore. And you're going to live in this village that the federal government is going to build. A kind of an amount of autonomy, a link with their own mobility was broken there. Mm. And so...
And as Richard said, built it in a floodplain.
Yes, the bullying, they used to call that in Ireland, where you move the stock up the mountain and down the mountain and you move the entire village, that sort of thing. But I wanted to ask you about another more... concrete aspect. You were going in there, a kind of Livingston in Darkest Africa kind of a feel, you know. This anthropologist arriving with a camera who's going to study us and all this kind of thing, and he's one of them, these awful people in the American government, the kind of people. And was there a problem that you had? Were you all on your own, or did you have a sound man?
No, I was on my own.
You're flying into this village, you're looking for a place to stay, you're fraternizing, there aren't pubs and things, are there? And,
no.
The practicalities of that. How did you ingratiate yourself into this township kind of situation?
I'll try and be brief. That really was the work of the first year, because they are used to a white person coming in, and usually it's not in a very positive context. They might be their teachers, which are mostly positive, social workers, tax collectors, accountants, whatever. They are kind of arms of the federal government. And then sometimes there's journalists, news reporters who come in for a day, do a package and leave. I was different in that my trips would be long. There would be 2 to 3 weeks. And so they were always surprised after 2 or 3 days that I was still there. And then on the second trip and into the third trip, as Grant Cashtook, the school principal, as he started to read about Ireland and Irish history and understand what Irish meant in the context of everything else. And he realised that we were colonised rather than colonisers. And so conversations with him then started to open doors where he believed that I might be able to see things from their perspective. And so really on that, it wasn't until the third trip that all sorts of doors started to open. And also because on trip one, I said I'd be coming back. And they said... yeah, sure, you know, see you again. And then on trip two, they're like, oh, you came back. Okay. And at the end of that, I said, I'm coming back again. They said, yeah, right. And when I came back the third time, they were like, okay, this guy is, you're serious. You're actually serious about this. And then a lot of the stories started to flow. And frequently, kind of to answer that earlier question, frequently it's about talking to people without the camera. You know, it's about all the time, all the things that you do without the camera. It's cups of tea. It's, helping gut the fish. It's all of this very soft stuff that does generate genuine intimacy, such that when it's time to pick up the camera, they're no longer talking to unknown white cameramen. They call they would call me a gossock at the start, which just means, you know, generic outside white man. By the time you've generated some actual intimacy and you turn the camera on, you get much better intimacy than on camera. You get honesty, you get emotion, you get real stories. But that takes a long time. You won't do that. You simply won't do that on a 2-day trip to do a news report. You may not. I didn't get it until trip number three, so I'm in week 5 and 6 of shooting. So, again, it's very luxurious, but essential to feature documentary to have that long run in.
And have they seen the film, and what did they think of it?
So I flew to the village without cameras in December, just gone, and we projected the film on the wall of the gym. And on the first night, about half the village came to see it, and the response was massively positive. There's one character in the film called Stanley Tom, who is kind of the, not quite the villain of the piece, but he's the compromised person in the piece. He is the only person I heard express displeasure. And many people, the women in particular, came up to me afterwards and said, that's us, you know, we can recognise ourselves in that. And for me, that's the bar. When you make a film, when you make a documentary, you should be able to show it to the people who are in it and have them shake your hand at the end and go, that's okay, we see ourselves in that.
I'm just wondering how the good people of Malahide would feel if a documentary maker was to fly in from wherever, Alaska, perhaps.
Yeah.
Would you take part in it?
And talk about their Range Rovers.
Yeah, their Chelsea tractors. Well, how would you feel about it?
I'm
being serious.
If an Alaskan filmmaker came to Malahide...
Why wouldn't they be curious about you people and how you live?
They should absolutely do that. They should absolutely do that. I think that would be massively important. In fact,
interesting for all of us to see.
Well, I've had two visitors from the village over since filming stopped late last year. So Jackie has been to Dublin.
Right. And how do they view the way you live? Because I know in the movie the walls are paper thin, they don't have running water, they're using the toilet bucket, the honey bucket, is that what you call it?
The honey bucket, yeah.
So, I mean, they don't have those kind of basic services that we have.
No, but again, they wouldn't be so alien to them, because the village is that particular type of life. Harold describes it as a third world life. But they are only a short flight away from... In Bethel, they do have running water, and they have
toilets.
But
where they live, they don't.
No, but what I mean is, if they came here, it wouldn't be so exotic. Because, again, they're American citizens. A lot of... Bosco is in college, went to college in Fairbanks. So they're not so disconnected from the first world, but they don't get to live. They don't get to live in the first world in their village.
Well, certainly, do they want to? Yeah.
Now, that's kind of the core question that both Harold is asking himself and Raman is asking himself during the seal hunt. You can go to a city, you can get a job, and you can earn money, you can live in a house, and you can have all of these benefits, but you lose that freedom. There's a tremendous amount of freedom, which is one of the reasons I kept going back. Like, the village is quite a poor place, but it's also a wonderful place. There was a day when we finished doing some work, and we went back to his house, and his mother said, there's nothing for the dinner. And so Raman picked up a rifle, and we went and we walked a mile past the airstrip, and we waited, and we shot 4 geese. Now, I say we, he shot the geese. I didn't shoot the geese. But that took about an hour. We shot 4 geese, he brought them back to his mother, she stripped them, dressed them, and that was dinner for the night. It's not performative when they say that's important to them. They want to live. And so they realise that if you go to the city, that's what you lose. And most of them aren't willing to make that trade. Harold was, and to a certain extent is a little bit miserable about that. Well, because he knows what he's given up.
It sounds fascinating. Where can we see it?
You can see it in Irish cinemas beginning the first week of October.
Great.
It's going to be on in Rathmines.
In Omniplex there, or Stella?
In Omni, I believe.
Okay.
It's going to be in the Lighthouse, the IFI. We're having a screening at the Gate in Cork, and I want to say the one in Galway.
Yeah.
Hashtag Losing Alaska, and also Breakout Pictures are doing the release. So there'll be information
all over.
It should be hard to avoid.
It will be very easy for our listeners, because just go to our website and you should be able to find the details there, which is rte.ie/Mooney. Tom, thank you very much indeed. Now, how many times have you been out for a walk only to come across an animal in distress? A young bird that has fallen out of a nest? A hedgehog wandering around during the day? Or a seal pup stranded on a beach. What should you do? Ring the Gardaí, ring the local SPCA, or maybe ring a local wildlife rehabilitation organisation. There are many excellent wildlife rehab organisations throughout the country. Most are voluntary and run by a small number of dedicated people. Recently, a conference organised by Wildlife Rehabilitation Ireland took place in Sonarta, which is an interactive visitor centre promoting ecological awareness and sustainable living based in County Meath. Rehabilitators were invited from all over the country to meet, share ideas and, more importantly, gain valuable knowledge and practical information from leading wildlife experts. A key focus of the conference was an exciting initiative to establish a national wildlife hospital, which is hoped will be in operation within a few short years.
It's going to be a wildlife rehabilitation and training hospital. So it's going to be like a central hub, basically, for rehabbers all over the country. That's going to be in the Fingal area.
And if you want to hear about this, you can just log on to the website or download our podcast. And that's rte.ie/Mooney, because Terry Flanagan has made a special report for us there. So more Mooney Goes Wild when you finish listening to this programme now by simply visiting the website, rte.ie/Mooney. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Jarlath Holland, to Sheila O'Callaghan and Sheila Neveal on sound. We'll do it all again next week. In the meantime, visit the website, rte.ie/Mooney. Goodbye.